This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This summer, for our series On Location, we are revisiting movies where place is so important it might as well be a character. And today we take you to the Ozarks of Missouri.
Way down in Missouri, where I heard this melody when I was just a little baby on my mama's knee.
The film Winter's Bone was nominated for 4 Academy Awards last year, including Best Picture, and it is set in a painfully poor Ozarks community where the illegal methamphetamine trade flourishes. As NPR's Neda Ulaby reports, the movie's vivid sense of place is due in large part to one man.
Winter's Bone is set in the bleak chill of southwest Missouri in its darkest season, when the trees are black spikes and the hills are bleached silver and rust. The story follows the travails of a 17-year-old girl whose father, a meth cooker, goes missing while out on bail. A local sheriff breaks the bad news.
Where you all come into this is, he put this house here and your tin breakers up for his bond.
He what now?
Jessup signed over everything. If he doesn't show at trial, see, the way the deal works is, you all gonna lose this place.
Reed Dolly must find her father to save her family from homelessness. Her quest leads her into a harrowing underground, where blood ties offer no protection from the drug trade's brutality.
What are we ever going to do with you, baby girl?
Kill me, I guess.
That idea's been said already. Got any others?
Help me.
Last year, the director of Winter's Bone, Deborah Granick, told All Things Considered that the movie never would have happened without a man who lives in Taneyville, Missouri, near where it was shot.
The fate of this film was tied to a local fixer, if you will, or guide. His name is Richard Michael, and he sort of paved the way for us to make it happen.
Meet 51-year-old Richard Michael.
I'm a bus driver, boat captain, and pretty good liar.
This part, though, is true. Michael's sister worked for the Missouri Film Commission. She called to see if he could help some New Yorkers who were trying to adapt the novel, Winter's Bone.
I did feel like I was sometimes the translator between Hillbilly and New York.
Michael helped the New Yorkers interpret a world where people split wood to keep warm, hunt for food, not sport, and where meth-related arrests are regular news. But Michael says the filmmakers were quick to understand the area's beauty.
The landscape here in the Ozarks, there's something special about it. It just becomes a part of who you are.
When Richard Michael started working on Winter's Bone, filming would not begin for 2 years. He started by finding locations, ponds, caves, burned out old buildings that really were former meth labs.
He's known for knowing what he's doing.
Well, you cook long enough, this is bound to happen.
You're saying Dad's up there burnt to a crisp?
That's what I'm saying.
I'm going up for a look.
No! It's poison. It'll rip the skin off your bones.
If Dad's up there, I'm bringing him home to bury.
Ray!
He also found the home Ree Dolly fights so hard to keep in the movie. In real life, the hand-built house belongs to a man named Frank Layson, and it's rich in visual details.
Frank is a recycler, you might say. He wouldn't let anything go to waste, and so there was a lot of things there that he had used or would use down the road, anything from old school buses for storage to old mobile homes that were going to be recycled for metal.
Ashley, go on, come inside.
Layson's 6-year-old granddaughter was always around during shooting, and the filmmakers ended up casting her as one of Ree's 2 siblings. Little Ashley Thompson was a natural. In fact, Michael says she's the most realistic part of a scene that's still embarrassing to him, where the kids shoot and skin a squirrel.
I always said they butchered the butchering scene.
All right. Now get your fingers in there. I'll get mine in. I'm just going to slit it down here. Now get in there. Get them guts out.
I don't want to.
Sonny, there's a bunch of stuff that you're going to have to get over being scared of.
Michael says the actress who played Ree, Jennifer Lawrence, almost lost her nerve when she had to teach her on-screen brother how to disembowel that poor squirrel. You can tell watching the little local girl playing their sister.
You look at her face, and she was actually in disbelief at their inability to skin a squirrel.
Michael went from finding places to shoot to finding props. Chainsaws, rusty old trucks, Christmas lights, even the coarse burlap bag covering Ree's head in one climactic scene where she learns her father's fate.
You can go and take that sack off now.
The prop department came up to me and said, we got to have a burlap sack. Where in the world can we find a burlap sack? I said, oh, over at the mall in Branson, they have a store, Bags R Us. Oh, really? Oh, good. Can you give us the phone number? And, you know, so I'm pulling their leg. That's what we do. But anyway, they were swallowing that hook, line, and sinker. But I said, I've got a burlap sack for you. It's okay. Calm down.
The Ozarks landscape of Winter's Bone is cultural, too. Lots of banjo playing.
Everybody said, you know, you can't have a banjo in a movie about the Ozarks, not since Deliverance, you know, you just can't.
The local musicians in the film and on the soundtrack would beg to disagree. One of the musicians, Meredith Sisko, spent this past summer touring as part of the Winter's Bone band. Sisko says seeing her part of the world come alive on film was deeply meaningful.
Tempted and tried.
I know that the Ozark Highlands are underlain by the St. Francis Range, which is one of the oldest mountain ranges on Earth.
Why it should be thus all day long.
And so what you have is a very thin skin of soil and trees and stuff on top of this mass of granite and limestone.
Hard scrabble country, she says, that shapes the bodies and lines the faces of the people who live there. People wary of outsiders until they get to know them. Outsiders are probably rare in the shabby, roughneck bar where Richard Michael makes his one appearance in the movie. He's an extra in a scene where Ree and her uncle try to gather information. She comes in, cautious, right next to Richard Michael.
There's me standing there in a black stocking cap and round coveralls, and props comes over and they stick a cigarette behind my ear. And so, I got a big bushy black beard. So.
That's how you'll know him if you ever visit Taney County. Richard Michael says you're invited. He runs a boat for tourists on Table Rock Lake near Branson, Missouri. That's a good place to visit, he says, best in spring or autumn. As for winter in the poorest part of the county, the movie's probably as close as you'll want to get. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
Thinking about the days that used to be.
And if you want to get a look at Richard Michael making his brief appearance in Winter's Bone, go to our website, npr.org. There you'll also find stories about the places behind Touch of Evil, The Shawshank Redemption, and Giant, all for our series On Location.
High on the mountain, standing alone, wondering where the years of my life have flown. High on the mountain, wind blowing free, wondering if you ever think of me.
And so that super committee you just heard about is searching for ways to cut the nation's big deficit. Many Americans have expressed concern about the deficit. Families who say they don't like to carry debt say they aren't really comfortable with the idea of the country being weighed down by the same problem. Economists have long debated this point, and many say that a federal deficit is not such a bad thing. One economist who holds this view is Professor James Galbraith from the University of Texas. We reached him in Vermont. You had an article recently in which you called the federal deficit like an IV bag in an emergency room. What did you mean by that?
Well, the IV bag in an emergency room provides a fluid, saline solution, that keeps a patient who's very sick alive.
Sure.
What the federal deficit does, the federal government spending in excess of what it takes out of the economy in taxes, is to put money into the pockets of private individuals, of businesses, and it keeps them able to continue their consumption. So it buffers the effect of the severe economic shock that we had 3 years ago and makes it less difficult for ordinary citizens to get through times when their incomes are low and when they may be experiencing bouts of joblessness.
Let me just make sure I understand that. So in a tough economic time, it's almost like a measure of the burden being shifted to the government. The government's spending more. Sure, a deficit is forming, but it means there's more money in the hands of people in the private sector.
Yes, exactly so. The federal government's deficit is exactly the extra funds that are being transferred to the private sector, dollar for dollar, penny for penny.
Some of the sort of alarming numbers about where the deficit and the debt might go are based on the assumption that interest rates will go up. When the Federal Reserve said that interest rates are going to stay low for the foreseeable future, is that another reason that people should not be worrying about these sorts of things?
Well, let's distinguish between the deficit that we have now, which is basically the result of the high unemployment rate and the flat private economy. And then we have these projections for deficits that are supposed to occur over the next 10, 20, 30 years. And those projections are basically computer exercises carried out by agencies like the Congressional Budget Office. Mm. And so they're based on certain assumptions. And one of the critical assumptions is the idea that the Federal Reserve is going to jack up interest rates from the present practically zero to somewhere between 4% and 5%, and it's going to do that in, let's say, 3 or 4 years. And this is extremely improbable. If the Federal Reserve did that, the economy would tank. People would not be able to pay their mortgages. Housing prices would crash even further. Unemployment would skyrocket. So we can safely assume that this projection isn't going to happen.
The notion that debt is bad is just something that seems to resonate with people. If you're a politician, President Obama, another candidate, how is arguing otherwise politically feasible? How do you go out there into a cafe or a sandwich shop at a campaign stop and convince people that, you know, you really don't have to worry about this?
I think you have to give people credit for basic common sense and economic intelligence. Americans have been going into debt to buy houses. They've been taking out mortgages for the most part until the last few years, very successfully. Every company goes to the bank and takes out a loan in order to finance its capital investment. Corporations issue bonds and keep issuing them, and their debt loads go up. The difference is that for the government, this is even easier because unlike a private household or even a company, the government is in control of the means of payment. We need these deficits. We need the government's presence in the economy. Without it, if you just cut back willy-nilly on government expenditure, it's like running through the emergency room and pulling out the IV needles from people's arms. It's not going to help them get better. It will certainly make their condition worse.
That's the view of Professor James Galbraith. He's an economist who teaches at the University of Texas.
Yet another story about financial regulators is turning heads today. A staff member at the Securities and Exchange Commission has complained to Congress that thousands of investigative documents were destroyed by the agency. The whistleblower says some of those missing papers relate to huge investment banks and their role in the 2008 mortgage crisis. NPR's Carrie Johnson has that story.
Longtime SEC staffer Darcy Flynn is asking Congress to protect him from retaliation after blowing the whistle on document destruction that he says stretches back for 20 years. Some of the missing files involve early-stage inquiries the agency made into the workings of Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, and Lehman Brothers.
The same big banks that delivered us the 2008 financial crisis.
That's Gary Aguirre. He's a lawyer in San Diego who brought Flynn's allegations to the attention of Congress. Aguirre is a former SEC whistleblower himself, and he's one of many people who are calling for more accountability on Wall Street and for more action from the SEC.
I just think that when you've destroyed 9,000 files of investigations, it makes sweeping under the table a lot easier.
Iowa Republican Senator Charles Grassley, for one, is paying attention. Grassley wrote to SEC leaders about the allegations, first reported Wednesday by Rolling Stone magazine. Grassley says he wants more information from the agency.
We know that Bernie Madoff, that there were several allegations against him that were never followed up on by the SEC. So basically, I just want to know that the SEC is doing its job, to protect middle-class 401ks and other investments.
An SEC spokesman says in a written statement that there's nothing wrong with how the agency handled internal documents. The spokesman says, quote, "There's no requirement that every document that comes into an agency's possession in the course of its work must be retained." And that view is getting some support from outside analysts who follow the SEC.
My initial take on this is it's a tempest in a teapot.
That's University of Denver law professor Jay Brown.
What appears to be going on here is the SEC would look at a matter, decide not to bring the case, and largely purge the file of documents.
The kind of documents that might include newspaper articles or anonymous tips. Anything that might have prompted the agency to start a file called an MUI for matter under inquiry. Jacob Frankel is a securities lawyer in Washington.
A MUI is nothing more than someone has called in with a complaint or some staff person has made a decision that there is something to at least look at the most preliminary level.
Frankel says there's no allegation the SEC tossed sensitive documents from banks it got under subpoena in high-profile cases that investors and lawmakers care about. So the debate boils down to this. What does an investigative record mean to Congress and the courts? Under the law, those investigative records must be kept for 25 years. But federal officials say no judge has ruled that papers related to early-stage SEC inquiries are investigative records. The SEC's inspector general says he's conducting a thorough investigation into the allegations, and he tells NPR he'll issue a report by the end of September. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
A major player in the board game industry has emerged from a beach house in Rhode Island. Bananagrams is the name of the company and also its popular game, an anagram puzzle built for speed. If that's stumping you, think Scrabble without the board or complicated scoring. Bradley Campbell of member station WRNI spells out why the company's thriving despite a downward trend for sales of most board games.
The first time Seth Snyder played Bananagrams, he became an addict. It made sense. The 25-year-old industrial designer is into word games and puzzles, but nothing had him this hooked.
A year ago, I'd never even heard of the game. And then I think my friend Joshua brought it over, and he took it out and taught us how to play, and it was just super fun.
On a muggy August night, Snyder and eight of his friends crowd around his kitchen table. It's elbow to elbow with scant space for their beers. All are geared up to play Bananagrams.
How many letters should we get? 7 or 11? Probably 7.
Well, that's the beauty of the game. We can do whatever you want.
We can experiment. Let's try 7.
This is how it works. Scrabble-like tiles come in a banana-shaped pouch. A player unzips the pouch, then puts the tiles on the table. Each person uses tiles from the center to form words that connect with each other. When no more tiles in the center are left, the first person to form words with all their tiles wins and yells,
"Bananas!"
Snyder and his buddies usually play late into the night or until one falls asleep. They say it's hard to stop playing, and that's what Rena Nathanson and her late father were looking for when their family invented the game in a beach house in Narragansett, Rhode Island, 6 years ago.
We wanted a game that we could play faster than Scrabble.
Nathanson's father, Abe, had been frustrated by the slow, plodding nature of Scrabble, but he loved word games, so he ditched the board, took the tiles, and began to form and reform words. The family joined in and acted as guinea pigs for the game, creating the basic rules as they played.
So we came up with the game Bananagrams, and we started playing it just with friends and with family, and we became very addicted to it.
The family had some games made for local toy stores, and they immediately sold out. Then in 2006, they launched the game at the London Toy Fair.
Thought it would be sort of successful, you know, and a little bit popular, but we had no idea. We really had absolutely no idea what a phenomenon it would become.
So how many of these little Bananagram pouches have been sold?
These little yellow Bananagram pouches, there are probably about 5.5 million floating around the world today.
Five and a half million?
5.5 million, yeah, to date.
Bananagrams is bucking the trend of most board game sales. Even toy giant Hasbro saw its games and puzzles division drop by 12% over the last 3 months. This while smartphone games are growing. The app Angry Birds just passed 300 million downloads.
But Adrian Appel thinks Bananagrams will continue to flourish. The spokesperson for the Toy Industry Association says it has mass appeal.
Bananagrams is really turning into a classic game, although it is only introduced, you know, the last couple of years. It's really starting to, you know, really have that stature of a long-lasting game that we envision will be played by generations of kids to come.
Bananagrams now sells variations of the game for younger players. They come in pouches shaped like apples and pears. And yes, there's a Bananagram app, too. You know, just in case bird flinging gets old. For NPR News, I'm Bradley Campbell in Providence.